Hello, and welcome to the Comic Book Page Podcast. My name is John Mayo, and I'll be your host. The segment you're about to hear originally ran as part of Comic Geek Speak episode number 231, which was originally released on March 8th, 2007.
All right, and to move to our Mayo report for this month, we have Mr. John Mayo, as well as everyone's favorite retailer, Brian Hibbs.
Hey there.
Hey.
How you doing? We gotta play your...
Yeah, here.
Here, we'll play the intro.
Live from Texas, it's John Mayo with the Mayo Report.
It's not complete without your introduction.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate it.
How you gentlemen doing?
I'm doing pretty well. How about you, Brian?
Everything's good here.
Cool.
Great. So we're here to look at the top 300 sales, top 300 comics. This is January, yes?
This is January, yes.
And to kick it off, John, you had a great thing you wanted to focus on for this one, which is the reason why we brought Brian on as well, as from a retailer's point of view, to talk about the sales of 52 leading into what a retailer has to do and what a buyer has to do with the new DC countdown.
And I have it easy because, you know, I just look at the numbers after they come out and say, oh, wow, look at what it did. I mean, people like yourself, Brian, you know, who are retailers who actually have to order these things in advance. I mean,
sure.
I don't know how you guys do it.
It's a little tricky sometimes. You know, and then the other thing is we're in a completely different place with the data than you are.
Right, yeah.
You know, because what we order isn't necessarily what is actually selling at any given point. You know, our 52 sales have been, I'm not going to say all over the map, but there's certainly a range of how many copies we're selling of any given issue, depending on the contents and depending on what's happening that week and any number of factors. So it becomes a little tricky sometimes trying to come up with the right numbers.
Oh, I can imagine, because also, I mean, you know, with the numbers we're looking at now, we've obviously had time to read the January stuff, but, you know, looking at what they've got in the solicitations for Countdown, it's like there's virtually no information.
It's true, yeah. It's I don't know how aware you are of this, but they didn't release the information at all until the day the preview shipped. That's a problem for stores like mine who do subscription services, because I wasn't able to generate the copy that I needed to try and sell the book properly because there was a moratorium on the information. You know, DC didn't even officially announce that 52 even existed until previews came out.
Wow.
Our print deadline for our in-store newsletter is the same day the previews comes out, so you know we had to sort of rely on what Rich Johnson said, the book existed at all.
That's incredible, because I mean this seems like a major risk to me, more so than 52, because again it's another weekly thing. There have been a lot of events going on. I'm afraid some readers may start to be getting burnt out on events.
Absolutely. At the end of the day, what's going to matter is whether Countdown is any good or not, and that'll determine what it sells. We don't know because we've got no idea. I mean, you know, presumably, I'm pretty sure that DC is going to make the first 12 returnable under the same terms they did with 52, and that'll mitigate the risk to a certain extent. But I think Countdown is going to be different than 52 in a lot of ways. With 52. There's been very little, as you can see in the charts, there's been very little attrition through the series. For the most part, people who are on, even if they're not enjoying the current number of issues, they're going, okay, well, I said I was going to be in for a year, so I'm in for a year. You know, with Countdown, I'm not so sure that that's going to happen at this point.
Well, from what little I've read in the solicitation stuff, it seems like it's much more of a rotating creative team and rotating content. So it seems like it could have all the pitfalls of a typical anthology book, where those tend to be a lot more all over the map in terms of sales and a lot harder to pull readers from issue to issue.
Yep, quite often.
Now, do you think some readers are going to see this as a continuation of 52?
Well, yeah, obviously. You know, I mean, my very first thought was, it's 104.
Yeah.
You know, and then you know and Countdown has another peculiar problem with it, that it's because it's counting down, and that really confuses the audience a lot of times. You know, wait, which issue am I getting? Is this? Am I? When you get to number 47 or something like that, and wait, do I need 48 now, or do I need 46? You see what I'm saying, right?
Oh, I know exactly what you're saying. It's going to throw my entire number crunching process into complete chaos.
Exactly. I mean, you know, we had this problem once before with Zero Hour, and there was certainly a lot of confusion there, and there were only five of those.
Yeah.
You know, with 52 of them, it's going to be interesting to see how it pans out.
Now, is there 52 of them or 51? Because it starts at 51.
It starts at 51 and counts down to zero.
Yep.
Ah, it's a zero-based thing. I caught on that. I don't know why they do these sorts of things. It makes, you know, keeping track of this stuff just, you know, more trouble than it needs to be.
Well, I mean, I think they're thinking it's a fun idea, but they don't really think about how it affects number crunchers. They care. Or back issues or you know, retailers, you know, because that's not what they're thinking about. You know, they're thinking about, hey, that's a clever idea. We'll count down to zero, and presumably at month zero, then it's going to be the next event, because obviously it's a countdown to something.
Right, that's right. I mean, I was surprised they went with another weekly series, much less one of this length, and that they bumped up the cover price.
Were you surprised, John? Really?
Yeah, I was.
I'm not.
I'm not at all. I mean,
no,
I
52. Sold really, really well. So, I'm not at all surprised that they're doing it.
Yeah, I mean, I looked at it as, you know, the first one was a unique thing. It was hugely experimental in the first weeks, and obviously the roller coaster ride has gone on. But I looked at it as before even the Countdown news was released, I said, well, they're going to put out a weekly series, you know, it's going to be probably an all-encompassing DC Universe kind of thing. And what I assume that they probably would want is some sort of leveling off process so that it just becomes part of the line, like a Superman book, like a Batman book. Here's your DC Universe book. I didn't know that they were going to do it to this scale, but I certainly, talking about the sales success for 52, yeah, I knew they were going to put another one out.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the big surprise is that they didn't put any kind of a rest between the two.
Well, I mean, it makes sense that they don't, because they've gotten people trained to get back to the store every week. Why break that cycle? I mean, it makes sense, and on those lines, I wasn't surprised, but it's got all the hallmarks of, you know, again, the 104 kind of continuation of 52 aspect. The, you know, we've been in a nonstop event after event after event mode, and I think a lot of things that made 52 successful, like having a year carved out of continuity and stuff like that, aren't going to apply necessarily to Countdown. Now, certainly there are going to be other things to mitigate that, but if you look at all of the weekly things that DC has done over the years, back when they did the Superman titles essentially as a weekly, back when they did Action Comics as a weekly, I mean, by and large, they have not been successful. So the question is this a fluke? Is this a success they can replicate? And, I mean, certainly, since it's been selling just about, you know, 100,000 or more copies each and every week for the last, you know, whatever we're on now, you know, that's a success. But on the flip side, you look at the sales charts, and, I mean, it has been, you know, slowly losing readers pretty much across the board.
Yeah, but very slowly, and I think at a much, much lower rate than anybody expected.
Oh, totally. It's usually closer to 8% than, you know, the 3 to 5 or whatever tends to be more typical.
Yeah, I mean, I was expecting at this point, you know, if you had asked me a year ago, I mean, I would have guessed that at this point 52 would be in the, you know, 50 to 60 range.
That's about where I would have put it too, actually.
So what do you think, what are you getting, Brian, as from your retailers? Why do you think it's still a buzz book?
Well, I mean, again, I think part of it was the discreet idea of it. I mean, that people are thinking, I'm in for all 52 issues because it's the experiment. I'm going to be part of that experiment. You know, in terms of replicating it, I it comes down to, is it going to be any good? Is what's the content going to be? In a lot of ways, the analogy that I would make is that for Countdown to be successful, it's going to have to be more like Heroes and less like Lost. in that there has to be, you know, you watch Heroes and every week there's a revelation. In fact, there's usually three revelations. There's one at the beginning of the episode, there's one in the middle, and there's one at the cliffhanger. Lost, on the other hand, just spins the plates and spins the plates and spins the plates, and you can go weeks without anything happening whatsoever. I don't think that the audience is going to put up with weeks where nothing happens on the second go-round. I think they were willing to put up with it on the first go-round because of the novelty of it. Just like at the beginning, Lost was a very popular show, and now people are abandoning the show in droves because they can't, you know, they want something to happen.
Well, it's interesting you make that comparison, because I think one of the other key differences between Heroes and Lost is Heroes is doing a much better job keeping all of the characters in play.
Yep.
You may not see them each and every episode, but you at least hear about them and have some idea what's going on. Whereas both in Lost and in 52, I mean, weeks could go by, if not months, between seeing certain characters. And then by the time you see them again, it's like, oh yeah, wait, where were they again? So it'll be interesting to see if Countdown can kind of address that issue, or if it even tries to. You know, I'm starting to wonder if it's going to have each issue potentially focus on, you know, a different character or whatnot. Because if you look at that two-page spread they gave us, it's got about 50 or so characters on it.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's not a lot of clarity what the structure is going to be, and I mean, we'll find out as it comes along. I don't want to prejudge the book before it comes out. You know,
no,
I
certainly
just,
not. I agree with that.
You know, my concern is that the audience is going to be a little burned out on it. A statistic that, I mean, I don't know if this is if this applies nationally in any way, shape, or form, but in my store at least, Countdown has a disproportionately high subscription base. Typically, a book I'm selling somewhere between a third and a half is pre-orders. You know, in some cases it's down as low as 10%, but it's typically between a third and a half. For 52, it's about 60% are pre-orders. Of the 60% of the sales that are pre-orders, about 60% of those people do not come in on a weekly basis. They're guys who come in once a month, you know, once every 2 months and buy their comics. So I think, you know, because of the nature of 52, people said they were in for the year. The people who are the more occasional, in other words, like, so a third of my customer base is not coming in on a weekly basis and buying 52, they're pre-ordering it. Those are the people that I'm most worried about on Countdown. I'm not worried about the other two-thirds, which are buying it on a weekly basis. It's the guys who are coming in and doing it the other way.
Kind of the more casual readers almost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Brian, what kind of, we have some listeners who actually just started comic shops in the last 6 months. What kind of advice would you give to them with this kind of thing?
Well, I mean, the advice that I would probably give is go, assuming that the returnability is in place, you know, go strong on the first 12 issues to try and build the audience. I mean, if you don't find your ceiling on a book, particularly on a weekly book, I mean, if you don't have it when people want it, you're not going to sell it. Take the returnability and use that to find out what the top of your sales are, and then just go conservative from there.
I'm surprised that DC hasn't announced if it's going to be returnable or not. I would think as a retailer, you kind of need to know that now.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't think a lot of us are, you know, doing, haven't even started doing our orders yet. I mean, you know, the catalog was just last week.
I honestly thought they did announce that they were going to be returnable. I don't know where I read it, but I thought I was at the store on Saturday and reading something somewhere. I thought they said they were going to make it returnable.
I'm 98.9% sure that's going to happen based on conversations I had at WonderCon, but I don't believe it's been officially announced.
Okay.
And it'd be foolish not to make it returnable.
Yeah, it really would be.
Because it just seems like those first 3 months are such a high-risk period for retailers. I mean, 52 lost, you know, 40,000 sales, you know, in terms of the initial numbers and stuff at that point.
Yep.
So, interesting.
Yeah, no, I mean, and I don't think that, I also don't think the Countdown is going to start as high as 52 did. I suspect Countdown 1 will probably launch, say, 150 max. 52, if I recall correctly, did 160?
It's hard to tell because they had fudged their numbers a little to account for potential reorders.
Yeah, true.
But the numbers I have for it were 143,600 or so.
Right.
Brian, you're not willing to bet to eat a bug on that, are you?
No, I'm not gonna take any bug eating bets anytime soon. That was disgusting. Thanks.
Sorry, didn't mean to bring that up.
No, it's all good. It's all good.
For those people who don't know, this was on Ultimate Spider-Man, right? Whether or not it would hit 100 issues when it first came out, and he said he'd eat a bug, and lo and behold, he ate a bug.
Well, I'm a man of my word, but you know, let's be realistic. Nobody thought Ultimate Spider-Man was going to hit 100 issues.
I agree with you.
It was a pretty safe bet at the time, but I was wrong. So I was wrong. So I ate a bug. You know, such is life.
I was actually concerned back then that if it did, you know, be successful, and obviously it has been, that would almost, you know, doom the regular Spider-Man books. But it's funny because we're at a point where Marvel has more different continuities going concurrently than I think DC ever had with the multiverse. Between, you know, Spider-Man, the main titles, the Ultimate Spider-Man stuff, the Spider-Man Adventure stuff, it's, you know, incredibly confusing, I think, for a lot of people. So,
Brian, are you able to stay for a little bit more?
Sure.
Okay. Let's dig into the numbers. Anybody have any questions that they want to pose for John? Go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, I got one, John. I noticed there was a lot of reorder books that made the top 300 here. And you even sent a separate spreadsheet talking about The Boys, and I wanted to ask you a question on that.
Sure.
I was in New York about 2 weeks before the Comic-Con and went to Hanley's, and I bought issues 1, 4, 5, and 6 of The Boys there. They didn't have 2 and 3. And they said, oh, yeah, we'll put them on reorder. And I was back at Hanley's during the con, and they had restocked everything there. And this is, you know, in February. So the issues are still out there for reorder. How many reorders are we going to see for this? Now, it's getting a lot of buzz because it's been canceled by DC, but, I mean, issue 6 had 8,100 reorders for this month here. How much of reorders are going to the final numbers of the book here?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because it used to be that reorders didn't show up on the charts all that much. It's mm-hmm. now getting to where they're accounting for, you know, 10% of the charts, thereabouts. I mean, it's, you know, I'm having to rework how I do some of the number crunching because some of the initial assumptions I made, like reorders not happening that often, are now totally, you know, wrong. With Boys, it's been doing, you know, 4,500 or 6,000 or 8,200 or whatever units in reorders for issues 1, 2, 4, and 6, respectively. It's been an incredibly strong, you know, seller for a Wildstorm book, and I think when it moves over to its Dynamite, it's going to, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
That it'll do pretty well there. I think it'll take a hit in the numbers just because it's not at DC. But, you know, when I do my number crunching, obviously I can't look into the future and take into account sales that haven't been reported, but I do factor those in for later. So, you know, an initial comparison between, say, issues 1 and 2 would have shown that there was a delta of 4,500 or thereabouts, whereas, you know, both of them, you know, went up later to where the delta, you know, kind of dropped a bit to go there. I'm not sure I'm answering your question.
Well, I was just curious on, you know, the amount of reorders for this issue, and I get this title, and I guess one of the big reasons is because it's not going to be traded by DC.
Well, no, I think it was getting the reorders before that.
Oh, it was?
I think it was one that, you know, people just, you know, weren't sure if it was going to be successful or not. And this goes back to, you know, you've got very little information in previews to really go on.
Yeah, I mean, I would say as a retailer, it's been a genuine builder.
Yeah.
And long before the, you know, we're not publishing anymore thing, it was genuinely building audience.
Okay.
Which is, you know, reasonably rare these days, so it stood out.
I thought by issue 3 that it was something that was going to be a sleeper hit if it got a chance to build an audience. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it won't get that chance at DC, but again, fortunately, Dynamite's able to pick it up. So,
I mean, in a weird way, that's almost is going to be a good. This whole debacle has been almost a good thing, because it definitely has gotten out to people who probably never were interested in the book before, but you know, now they read about what happened and they're probably going to wait for Dynamite and pick it up now.
I'm really looking forward to seeing how it does at Dynamite, because this is one of the few times where there's a book that's got some momentum that had been building, had, you know, fairly solid numbers or whatnot, that's moving away from one of the main publishers to more of an up-and-coming publisher. And, you know, getting out of that front half of previews in towards that back half of previews. And I'm curious how many of the retailers, how many of the readers are going to follow it and, you know, how it's going to do over there.
It's sort of an odd choice for a Dynamite book, don't you think?
No, not at all.
Do they have other things along this line?
Well, I mean, why would it be an odd choice?
I just mean because
their own properties,
because of the content.
Seller, you know, I don't see any downside for them taking it.
I just mean because of the content.
I think it's a smart move for them because of the content. Again, and by that I mean in terms of it not being a licensed property. It would be very easy for Dynamite to get pigeonholed as, oh yeah, they do licensed properties like Lone Ranger, Battlestar Galactica, Red Sonja, those sorts of things. So to have something that's actually an original, you know, property, or granted it's heavily based on, you know, previous superhero mythos, etc., could be just what they need right now. So.
Hey, I want to take a look at number 254 on the charts. It was one of our indie challenge picks. Nightly News 3 went up 200 copies from 2 to 3.
Excellent.
Yeah.
I'm almost wondering if people, you know, if maybe they're afraid they're not going to find the issues, maybe they start to pre-order. I don't know.
I tell you, these days, if you want something coming out from an indie, you know, publisher, particularly the small press, it's smart to pre-order. That way you know, you let the retailers know, give them the information they need to order, and it helps ensure that the book keeps coming out. You know, I look at a few of these other things, like Exiles, which is down at 281 from Boom, and number 4 sold, 2,700, which is down about 400 from issue 3. You know, I read, I guess, issues 2, 3, and 4 the other night. And, you know, it's a good, solid, you know, sci-fi story or whatnot. So I don't know that if I were a retailer, if I would have necessarily taken a big chance on it or whatnot, if I hadn't had readers come and say, hey, you know, I want this. I mean, there's so many comics coming out. It really comes down to, you know, the right readers finding the right comics. And, you know, that kind of matchmaking is hard.
What would you say to that, Brian?
No, I think that's absolutely true. You know, it's difficult because there are so many titles out there, and there's only a finite amount of rack space. And you know, people are sometimes hesitant to experiment. So, you know, yeah, pre-orders are the best thing you can do to ensure that a book that you love is gonna continue. It's not realistic to expect retailers to carry everything, you know, unless they've got a footprint the size of Hanley's or Midtown or something. You know, most stores just aren't that big and don't have the space, the physical space to carry everything that comes out, let alone in you know, the appropriate depth. So,
Brian, do you feel you talked about building an audience. Do you try to do that with some of the books that aren't DC, Marvel, or Dark Horse or Image?
Oh, never. No, I hate comics. No, of course I do. Come on, seriously. What kind of question is that? That's the name of the game. You know, when you find something that you like, speaking both as a reader and a retailer, if I enjoy a book, then I'm gonna you know, proselytize it. That's just what I'm gonna do, because that's what my job is. That's why I own a comic book store. I love comics. You know. Whether, you know, I couldn't care less who publishes a book. What I care is the book any good? Is it going to find an audience that's going to be interested in it? And, you know, whether that's a book that nationally sells, you know, 1,200 copies or one that sells 100,000 copies, I'm going to push the book, you know, equally if I believe in it. You know, certainly there's any number of titles, you know, that come out where, you know, I can go, oh, geez, I'm 1% of the print run, or I'm 0.5% of the print run, you know, which is kind of scary when you think about it. Yeah. But that's, you know, well, I don't know what else to do there. You promote the comics the best that you can, and you hope the rest of the market eventually catches up.
Well, it seems to me from a reader perspective, and, you know, tell me if you agree with this or not as a retailer, that one of the best things a reader can do is get his retailer to know him.
Yep.
Because I figure the better, you know, if I were shopping at your store, the better you know what I like and why I like it, the better you can point me towards other things like it.
Exactly. No, of course. I mean, you know, it's the little game you play, you know, anytime you get a new customer in, you know, they say, oh, I heard about comics, I'm looking for a comic, I really don't know anything about comics, what can you tell me about comics? You know, the first question you ask them is, well, what do you like? You know, I mean, what books do you like? What movies do you like? What are you interested in? Because once I know that, then I can figure out what comic you'll dig, you know.
You know, it almost makes me wonder if there's any point putting together some kind of database that's accessible both to readers and retailers and stuff, and, you know, maybe even publishers if they'd care, that would act as kind of a, I don't say a matchmaking kind of a thing, but kind of a, gee, you like Teen Titans. Well, if you like it because of, you know, the characters, gee, go check out Robin. Go check out these other titles. If you like it because of, you know, the artist, well, he's done these other things. You know, I guess Comic Book DB does kind of some of that. It just seems like more of it needs to be done.
You just gave me a show idea. Brian, did you have a question?
Do I have a question?
No, I was talking to... We have three Bryans,
yes,
on the line.
Oh, okay.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
There's a quota of Bryans. I'm sorry.
John, what are the sales numbers on that?
John, the question that Shane and I had is the all-new Atom number 7. Why didn't we see a huge spike in sales for this issue?
I'm going to blame it on Marvel breaking the internet in half and people didn't know that it was Mike Norton that was doing it.
I will
say that the drop-off, which was only, you know, 1900, was the least amount of drop-off that the series has had to date.
We'll take that as a plus then, I guess.
Exactly. And really, you know, when I look at these charts every month, and I've said it time and time again, and I hope to be able to stop saying it soon, most titles aren't going up.
Right.
Usually, you know, less than 10% of the items on the top 300 go up. So, for something to have a not too bad decrease, you know, I'm almost getting to where I see that as a good thing. That kind of bothers me.
That just means that our listeners didn't pre-order the damn book.
Whoa!
Well, there's a natural entropy that virtually any book's going to have. It's just the nature of a continued project, you know. I mean, I'm sure that if you were to look at, you know, long-form book projects, let's say, you know, I don't know, Conan. There's like 28 Conan books or something like that. I'm sure that Volume 1 sells a whole hell of a lot better than Volume 28 does. It's just the nature of the beast, man. I wouldn't read anything into that about the health of the direct market. Drops are natural and inevitable, I think.
Well, we put out a cry because Mike Norton's a friend of the show, and he was filling in for two issues, so he did it on his show, we did it on our show, hoping that DC would see a spike, which they, you know, something must have worked because he's exclusive now.
And he's going to be on the book starting again at 12. Yeah.
Right, so, all right, you got another chance, people.
John, I don't see it on the list, but I was wondering if you had numbers, at least for the direct market, for Wizard magazine.
Yes, I do. Let me pull that up real quick. I put that together actually for Ian not too long ago. Let me see where I have that.
Brian, does that sell like hotcakes at your store?
No. No, Wizard's a pretty mediocre seller for me. we actually, you know, we have our own in-store newsletter, Onomatopoeia is its name, and we print about and give out about 300 copies a month of that. We sell about, I don't know, 25 copies of Wizard. So in terms of, you know, communicating things to my customers, I mean, I find that works better than the other, you know. Wizard doesn't have a huge impact.
All right, hang on. I'm still pulling it up. I've got some of the numbers in front of me. I'm trying to find the spreadsheet I put together for Ian.
I would assume that Wizard has multiple charts, one dealing with maybe direct market, another one dealing with subscriptions, and yet another one dealing with all the ones they put out in bookstores.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure that Wizard does a fairly reasonable newsstand market. I mean, certainly they do three covers every month, and one of those three covers is always clearly the newsstand cover.
Right. I've got, let's see, the most recent one I've got numbers for is, I think, 184, which is around 48,000 units thereabouts. It seems to usually be coming in with an effective ranking, I'm going to say, around 35 to 40 or so over the last couple of months if it had shown up on the comics list, which is down from where it had been because it used to be doing more in the 18 to 15 range in terms of, again, where it would have ranked on the comics charts. So, I mean, it sells better than a ton of comics, but it does seem to be having a downward trend.
John, I have a question on one, number 276 on your Hit Parade. It's the Midnight Dark Tower Gunslinger Reborn. Now, that's not the number. Is that the Marvel Spotlight?
I don't think it's the Marvel Spotlight because it would have been listed as Marvel Spotlight whatever.
So that's the Gunslinger Returns?
I'll be honest. I'm a little confused by some of these things that they're doing that are, you know, these book property type things, because some of the numbers I'm seeing look so low.
Yeah, because we ordered over 100 copies in our store alone, so I can't imagine 3,100.
No, those aren't the total numbers for Gunslinger.
I was going to say, I can't believe 31,000 is 3,100 is the total number.
My only possible thought there, and it's hard to say, is maybe that represents some of the midnight release copies.
Oh, okay. Because the ones that the Hanley's had the midnight signing.
They slipped into the January chart rather than it being a February book.
Okay.
Dark Tower is going to be a February book. It shipped in February.
That's what I thought. And when I looked at it, I was like, it had to be Spotlight. You know, if it was anything, it might have been the Spotlight Dark Tower thing. But because when I saw 3,100, I was like, oh, my Lord, that was, you know, we ordered over 100 for our store. I can't imagine that we were the only ones.
Yeah. Diamond's had a few things that have you know, like shipped in January but showed up on the December charts and a few things like that lately.
Okay.
So I don't know if they're retooling their process or exactly what's going on there.
Yeah, that just kind of jumped out at me.
Yeah.
John, you want to take one of your own hits on here?
Sure. Let's go with New Universal. Issue number 2, it did 44,800 units, and that is up 1,600 units from the first issue. Typically, we see a decline on second issues, so for this one to be going up, I see as a really good sign. Hopefully, that trend will continue. Even if it levels off at this range, that's still fairly healthy sales for a book these days.
Especially when based on the universe.
Yeah, there is that.
Comic retailers do have long memories, and I think a lot of people went way conservative on that title because they went, New Universe? Who the hell wants that?
Well, particularly after the Untold Tales of the New Universe, which should have stayed untold.
Yeah.
Well, I think this tops what those four things did combined. Because those were selling down at the 10,000 range, if I recall correctly.
Is that also the reason why Spider-Man The Reign did the same thing? You think just underordered
in
the first issue?
No, it was not based on New Universe. No,
you know what I mean. Low expectations on the first issue, and then the second issue takes a jump?
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, I mean, you know, the book sells out, and they do a second printing, and you know, so, yeah, no, I mean, those are expressions of true demand.
Yeah, I would agree with that entirely, particularly the jump of, you know, 10,000 units between issues 1 and 2. I think that's great. Be better for an ongoing, of course, than a miniseries. But hey, we take it when we can get it. So,
Then people wanted to see more of Peter Parker's winky.
Okay.
The other jump that kind of confused me a little was Ultimate Spider-Man 104.
Yeah, good job.
It went up to 108,100 units, which is a jump of 31,900 units, or about, you know, 41-42%. Part of that, I think, double-sized conclusion to the Ultimate Clone Saga. They're nearing the end of the Bendis and Bagley run. I think that may have factored in. But still, I was very surprised by this.
Well, it's the record-tying issue.
Oh, that's it. Okay.
I believe there was a 1 in 50 or a 1 in 100 variant. I don't know. I mean, I don't carry the variant, so I don't pay any attention to that, really. But I think there was a variant on that one. I mean, I know I bumped my order by a couple of copies, you know, just in case anybody cared about the anniversary. It turned out that the Clone Saga ended up being a very good story, and we sold them all. But I'm pretty sure that's what that's from.
Okay, that makes sense. I hadn't factored in the record-breaking aspect.
Yeah.
And, you know, the alternate covers. There's so damn many of them these days. I'm starting to go on the assumption that everything just has one.
Brian, you say you don't order variant covers.
No, not unless a customer specifically and consciously special orders it for me.
And what's your reasoning behind that?
I don't believe in them. I mean, I don't think. To me, the comic book is about reading it and not speculating on it. And when you have those limited variants, it's not like you can just put it out at cover price. You know, because if you put them on a cover price, you know, the eBay sharks are going to come and just snap them all up from you and then go and flip them themselves for $20, $25. You know, and I don't want to put them on my wall for $20, $25 because I don't think it's worth $20, $25 to buy a recent comic book that just came out this week that just happens to have a different cover. You know, it's charging $20 for a single piece of artwork, and I just don't think that's the way that I want to do business. That's not the way that I want to make money on comics. I want to make money on comics by selling the content.
Any chance you could convince the publishers to start doing that?
Well, I mean, I'm doing my part by not ordering those line items, you know, in the catalog. I mean, it's the best message that I can send. You know, unfortunately, a lot of other retailers like them, and enough of them do that you know, and as long as that's the case, then those books are probably there to stay for a while.
Brian, can I ask you, what if a customer comes in and does want something special ordered like that, like the Justice League and Justice Society have won every issue so far, what do you charge them, if I may ask, for...
I've been charging cover.
Okay. Wow.
You know, because that's good. That's what it's costing me. It's costing me a percentage of cover. The only situation where that would be a problem is if, let's say that it was a 1 in 100 variant and I was only normally ordering 60 copies of that book. In that circumstance, I'd ask the customer. I'd tell the customer, "Well, if you want to buy another 40 copies of the book, then that's the price I'll sell it to you at."
Sure,
But you know, on 1 in 10 variants like the Justice League ones, I mean, I qualify for 8 or 9 of them. So you know, it's no skin off my teeth to give it to someone who's genuinely looking for it because they're a collector of the thing, not because they're going to flip it, you know.
So you said 1 in 10. So you automatically get those, right?
Or, no, they're line items. Actually.
Oh, they're still line items.
Yeah, no, and that's, you know, partially because of retailers like me who say I don't want these in my store. Give me a way to opt out of these because you shouldn't be producing them and you know selling them to me if I don't want them. You know, in the circumstances where they do send them and we don't want them, I usually just donate those to the CBLDF and let them sell them on eBay. Because I figure if someone's going to make money off that, it may as well be, you know, a First Amendment organization.
Big kudos.
But, you know, the ones that really bother me are the 50-50 variants. Because, you know, when we don't have the option to say, no, I don't want those, and you've got these books cluttering up your rack and they look terrible, you know, because the customers go through them, you know, and so the, you know, they always get spread out and they look just awful on the racks. I wish we didn't have to deal with that. I'm sorry, I've gone off on a tangent, haven't I?
No, that was
I brought it up
because
I wanted to
kudos for you for how you handle it. It's very impressive.
Yeah.
How many retailers do you think like you?
I don't know, probably a small number. Yeah. You know, I mean, I know personally of 4 or 5, which means there probably got to be 50 or 60 at least, you know.
So,
you know, it's just a matter of why are you a retailer? Are you a retailer you know, because of the commodity or because of the aesthetic. And the reason I opened my store was because of the aesthetic. I totally 100% understand and agree with people who are in it for the capitalism. You know, that's perfectly fair. This is America. You know, but for myself, I'm much more about the aesthetic of the art form. And so, you know, I make lots of money selling comic books. I don't need to make $20 off someone because they want to be a completist. You know, it would make me feel scuzzy. You know, the two or three people who buy variants on any kind of occasion from me are they're always buying parent book as well. And so you know that they just want it to complete their collection. I mean, if I sold that guy that same book for $20, I would feel like a jerk, you know.
Is it safe to assume that if someone's buying a 1 in 100, that they're like you just said, if you only order 60 and you have to order that extra 40 to get it, are they eating that 40 even though they're selling it for 20? I mean, where do they make their money then?
Well, you know, on those books, you're generally setting the price that's at least your wholesale cost, and so what a lot of retailers use these for, and this is actually something I support. I mean, I don't do it myself, but you know what they do is they take the 1 in 100 and they price it at whatever the wholesale cost of 100 copies would be. So that in that case it would be $150, is that right? Something like that. As long as you sell your 1 in 100 variant, your 100 copies of the book are free, and so you can use them to seed people on the book. I mean, you can just give them out, you know, to try and get people to read the book in the future. And I do know some retailers, you know, specifically use variants for that purpose. I just like I say, I don't want to because I don't like the that collector's mentality. I just don't think it has a place in my store. But you know, for stores who don't care about that, that's a really good way to use it as a tool to sell even more copies in the future of a book.
I foresee a whole bunch of listeners going into their comic stores and going, "Where's my free copy? I see your 1 in 100 variant up there. I want my free copy."
No, I don't mean it like that.
I know. And in terms of numbers, I mean, that's the reason why we're sort of getting some of these numbers that are so huge. I mean, there's variants and then there's sketch variants and things like that. And they are having effect on the
numbers. I think an interesting project might be to try and determine what kind of effect they actually do have. It's kind of trying to hit a moving target because, you know, as more and more of these variants happen on more and more obscure books, they probably have less and less of an effect. But I'd be really curious if the bump from a variant cover is 5,000 copies or if it's, you know, 50,000 copies.
Well, we saw it on that Moon Knight variant on issue 6, right, John? That number went up like 9,000 or something. What was it?
It went up quite a bit. I'd have to pull that up.
And that one we knew was because of the variant because it was issue 6, and we knew the bloody variant was there. There was just no questioning.
Well, part of it's hard to determine, though, how much is actually the cover versus something else.
Well, that one, that was the last issue of that story arc, so it had to be the variant cover. I thought, when I wasn't here for that episode, but I did listen to it, and I went, that is the clearest example I think we have of what a variant cover can do for a book. Or what it does to a book, not what could it, but what it does. Because it was issue 6, it was late, and it had a bloody variant cover. Not to be British, but...
Now, did 7 have a variant cover? I do not think it did.
It was Casualties of War crossover.
Yep.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, because I was going to say, 7 did better than 6. So does that mean events trump variant cover?
Yeah, probably.
Well, expect your thesis, John, in next month's episode.
Well, we saw that in one of those Black Panther crossover. That one, it spiked for the Civil War thing, and the very next issue was back down to the same numbers again.
I mean, certainly with Civil War. I mean, that, in some cases, was doubling or almost tripling sales.
Right.
Yeah. Well, Civil War was a phenomenon, and I don't think that you can learn lessons from Civil War particularly. I mean, if Marvel's going into World War Hulk thinking that it's going to have the same kind of impact on sales, I think they're going to be sadly mistaken.
Oh, I'm sure they're going to be sadly mistaken. I can't imagine anything for the next few years being as wildly successful as Civil War was. That kind of thing, you just don't capture that kind of lightning that often.
The real question is, what is the effect of having Spider-Ham in your comic? You know, that's the lesson to be learned right here.
that one, did that show up in this month's number?
Yeah, 26,500 copies. That's a hell of a lot of copies of Ultimate Spider-Man.
I bought it.
It's number almost enough to account for everyone who said, I'll take anything with Civil War in the title.
It's number 76 on the chart.
Well, I wonder what the sell-through was, though, because mine was certainly pretty bad. I think a lot of people expressed interest going in, but when they actually saw the book, what it looked like, because it was, you know, half of it was just pin-ups.
Now, you're tied in with the retail organization Comics Pro, right?
Yeah, I'm on the board of directors.
Do you guys have any thoughts or plans on doing anything to start tracking sell-through?
Well, it's certainly, you know, it's certainly in our, this would be a great idea pile, but, you know, at right now we're still building the organization.
Right.
Because
I'm more than willing to help out on stuff like that, because I think it's not only interesting information, but potentially incredibly valuable information.
No, I completely agree. You know, I just right now the organization is basically run by the board of directors on a volunteer basis when we're not running our stores, okay?
Yeah, no,
until we get our membership up to, we probably need about another 30, 40 members, something like that. And then we can seriously start thinking about hiring an employee who can handle the task management aspects of these things. To do things on a volunteer basis, particularly when you're dealing with numbers and individual sell-through data, is not something that I think would be a good idea.
No, I agree. That's proprietary information, and certainly, you know, that's got to be handled carefully. I agree.
Yeah, there's got to be some accountability in there. I mean, not that I'm trying to turn down the offer for free work, but you got to think about those kind of things when you're dealing with whether people will be willing to give up their information. You know?
No, agreed. It's got to be something that's a win-win for everybody. The retailer's got to know that their proprietary information is safe, because I mean, if I were running a store, I would not want everyone to know how many of everything I sold.
Exactly.
That's bad.
So, you know, I mean, I think that we are going to work on doing something like that, but it's probably in the 5-year plan category, you know.
Okay.
Brian, what's the website for that organization?
Comicspro.org.
You want to make a little 1-minute plea?
A 1-minute plea. You know, I think that the direct market is a really strong and a really vibrant market, but I think that a lot of our vendors and a lot of our suppliers use our individuality as a way to keep us weak. You know, any number of times, I'm sure any retailer can tell you a story of when you ask for something or you know, a slight to be redressed, and you know, the publisher or the distributor said, "No, it's just you." I heard, "No, it's just you." About the unsolicited and late titles from Marvel, but talking with other retailers, I knew it wasn't just me that was losing sales and all that, and so that's, you know, why we did the class action lawsuit. I mean, one of the reasons that I helped form Comics Pro was so that nobody would ever have to do a class action lawsuit the way that I did again, so that there was an organization there that was looking out for the retailers and trying to prevent things from ever getting to the point where you would even have to think about legal action, you know, because the partners are respecting each other because they're speaking together and collectively. Comics Pro is, you know, at this point the most successful retailer organization ever. Not that that's saying a lot, but, you know, there have been, you know, 3 or 4 other attempts in the past, and they never got over about 40, 50 members, I don't think. I think maybe 60 was the highest. We're already at 90. We've got some of the biggest stores in the country as members, Mile High and Midtown, and, I'm not sure Midtown's actually joined yet. But the Beguiling and blah, blah, blah. There's a lot of stores involved. And, you know, we're trying to move things forward. We're trying to change things for the better in this business. I'm one of the board members. You know, Joe Field, who helped create Free Comic Book Daily, is another one of the board members. So you know that we are, you know, that we're thinking, we're trying to think about all retailers and not just about ourselves. And we're trying to fix the problems that face this industry and so everybody should join, because it's in your best interest to do so.
And that website is?
ComicsPro.org.
ComicsPro.org. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much. Brian, thank you so much for sticking with us. John, as always, it's a pleasure.
Cool.
We need to get going. But I think it's great to have as many point of views as possible. And
great.
Can't wait to get the feedback on this.
Sounds good.
Have a good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that wraps up this syndicated episode of the Comic Book Page Podcast.
My name is John Mayo, and I've been your host. If you have any questions or comments, my email address is podcast@comicbookpage.com. Thanks for listening.